Jonathan Lethem is one of America's finest novelists. His critically acclaimed books include Motherless Brooklyn, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, Fortress of Solitude, and Chronic City. Lethem's nonfiction work includes a long interview with Bob Dylan and a marvelous profile of James Brown, both for Rolling Stone. Jonathan Lethem's latest novel is Dissident Gardens. It's about American communists and leftists. Rose is a devoted communist until she's driven out of the party. Her daughter Miriam is equally political. She dies while visiting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Now there are also children, husbands, relatives, lovers, and acquaintances, but it's really Rose and Miriam who are at the center of Dissident Gardens. I asked Jonathan Lethem how he came up with these characters.
Structurally, they're very directly based on my mother and grandmother. And at the same time, that's only an entrance to a book like this. It's where you start, and then you start filling it all in with your projections and other stories and other lives and other research that attaches to it. And, you know, and there's a lot about my mother's life. She died when I was 14, and my grandmother's life that I don't know. So I had to submit to the wonderful forces of fiction. Once you invent characters and give them, set them careening through a story, they attract other kinds of properties. Mm-hmm. And but yeah, there's something of my grandmother's life in Rose for sure.
A lot of the book is about the political lives of these people. What interests you about this kind of eddy in American politics, American communists and far left people?
Well, I guess I don't see it only as a kind of an eddy, like a weird one-off. I see it as instead an extreme exemplification of something that's very real, still feels alive to me, and isn't even necessarily left-based. And it's just that America, the history of this country is a container for utopian and idealist schemes and dreams, that we this giant crazy container of a country has held and endured and disappointed or integrated all sorts of different visions of what the world should be like. It's like a place where utopias come to die, right? And so these characters are all, in their different ways, you know, very American in that they're trying to live in a world other than the one they've been given.
And the book traces this arc from the American communist movement and forward to those who are working on the Central America issue and right up to the present day with the Occupy movement.
Yeah.
And you see all these as being connected.
Well, I see that the human impulse to throw yourself into history with an attitude that it could matter, that you're alive and you could change things and it's urgent and you'll sacrifice for this, is very universal and deep. Of course, it is a impulse that becomes misused or betrayed or conflicted in so many different ways, and this book becomes partly a catalog of all those different kinds of disappointment.
Are you a political person yourself, Jonathan?
You know, I flatter myself if I think that I'm political. I have all sorts of political urgency emotionally. I feel it. But does it manifest in any kind of coherent action or even a kind of consistent point of view when I talk to people about politics? Probably not. I think I instead manifest all sorts of contradictions or limits.
You mentioned Rose and Miriam, both kind of based on your mother and your grandmother. Did you grow up in a very political household?
Yeah, we were marching all the time. There was always another thing to be marching, you know, for or against, and it felt native to me. It felt like this is what you do. You know, you take up a banner and you get out there. And it was, you know, in my generation, it was the tail end. I actually remember some anti-Vietnam protests, but then that same energy moved very quickly into marching for childcare center, daycare centers in New York City, or marching against, you know, a nuclear power in the Helen Caldicott era. I did a lot of that. And, you know, it was something that I took as a given.
The structure of Dissident Gardens I found really interesting. You could have told this in a straight chronological way, and yet it kind of ping-pongs throughout these eras, forward and backward. Yet I always sort of knew where I was in the book. Why did you kind of choose that way to structure it, to put it together? How did that serve what your goal was with the book?
Well, I guess part of it is that I distrust the historical novel as a form. It seems to me to take for granted something I can't, which is that you can go back and really build a past that's persuasive and, you know, that's objectively real. Instead, I felt we only know the past by making a version of it, a kind of diorama version of it, out of our own sense of reality, out of what we have available to us in the present. So I wanted the characters who were thinking about these situations and remembering them and, you know, excavating the past, I wanted you to feel the presence of the contemporary life.
At this point in your career as a novelist, I'll say mid-career novelist, do you feel like, I've got chops now I did not have in my earlier work. I can do things now I couldn't do before.
Oh, my God. Sure. I mean, I couldn't imagine setting out to write a book like this when I first began. And I thought I was, you know, cat's pajamas. I felt very extraordinary. But I was only able to do a very, very particular number of things at that point. And it had to do, above all, with my reading experience. I mean, I started writing novels. Well, I began trying when I was 18 years old, and I drew on everything I knew to that point. But I had decades more of discovering what literature could be by reading it before I could even begin to attempt these other things, let alone figure out how to do them.
So at mid-career, do you kind of look down the road and you go, these are the things I haven't done yet that I would like to do? Do you have that much of a plan?
Well, I relate to what you just suggested, because I have tended to be a writer who I'm really animated by the idea of changing what I do, starting fresh, kind of forgetting what I've just become an expert on and starting as an amateur again, having to reacquire a whole new set of skills. And so I do look for things that I haven't done. But, you know, you also start to acknowledge, well, time and time again, I seem to be interested in this, or I seem to do this well, or, you know, there's a lot of energy for me in a subject like, for instance, for me, New York City. You know, every time I go there, I find that some kind of dynamic love-hate relationship I have to the city that does a lot for my writing. So I probably also am inclined, as I get older, to accept what my strengths and limitations are, and to say I'm going to, you know, make sure I go to these energy centers again and do some of the stuff I do well.
Well, to any reader, your strengths are well known, but you see yourself as having weaknesses, things that you can't do as well.
You're always out on some tightrope of your own limitations, and the goal is not to pretend they don't exist, but to work to their very limit, you know, to do everything that's in your capacity and stretch and grow, you know.
Do you have an example?
Well, what's an example? I mean, I think that plot has always been rather mysterious to me, and so sometimes I have dealt with that by becoming very deliberate about it. You know, I wrote two books that are crime stories, and one of the reasons I did that, you know, not to suggest that it was an exercise, but I thought, well, a crime writer has to know the story. They have to figure out the plot so they can kind of distribute the clues and make it unfold. And I'm very proud of the effort that I put into that. But I think other times it's like an oasis that's in the middle distance. I see it or I don't see it. It becomes mysterious to me again. So a book like this, I evaded the problem completely. I made it, as you say, a kind of the form of the book is very centrifugal. It's like a memory book. It just things arise when the characters are thinking about them, and there's no plot structure at all.
Jonathan, you've done a lot of work writing about music, nonfiction about music. So I got to ask, what's on your iPod? What are you listening to these days?
Oh, gee, I've been listening to Mark Kozelek and the Red House Painters. I don't know, for some reason, I've loved him for a while, but he's just clicked in again for me. And his solo act is also called Sun Kill Moon. So that's a big one right now. I'm listening to tons of African music. But, you know, I'm very, unsystematic in my listening. I listen to a lot of stuff that people send me. I don't go to record stores and kind of try to figure it out for myself as much as I used to when I was younger.
And I don't have to make record stores anymore either, yeah. So it's a little harder. In 2006, you did this long interview with Bob Dylan for Rolling Stone. And I think it was the same year you did this awesome profile of James Brown while he was putting together an album. How did you kind of make that sideways step from being a novelist to writing about music?
That was a funny thing. I wrote about a music writer. My sixth novel, The Fortress of Solitude, the main character is a career, you know, rock critic, and he writes liner notes and does journalism and writes obituaries of musicians. And I think in some way I kind of pole vaulted myself into this fake profession, because people began to it's a very autobiographical book, and people began to think that I'd done what my character had done. In fact, people would say to me, oh, I used to read your stuff in Rolling Stone all the time, and there hadn't been any stuff in Rolling Stone. And weirdly enough, I think this carried over, and the editors at Rolling Stone themselves were mistaken. And so they started giving me these plum assignments that, you know, a real working critic should have done and would have killed for. But I wasn't going to, you know, I wasn't going to tell them that I was actually way over my head.
Dylan recently had a Rolling Stone interview that was fairly confrontational. I can't think of a more difficult interview than Bob Dylan. I mean, he perpetually is changing himself up and, yeah, and putting on new identities. What was that like?
Well, first of all, he was kind of a pussycat for me. It was a very, very congenial talk. And he was, for whatever reason, that day or that year with that album, he was inclined to try to engage with me, and he was quite sincere with me, but he was also being very funny. He was trying a lot to make me laugh. And I think actually when I read something like that more confrontational interview that you're referring to, I see it as a lot of those might have been provoking lines or attempted laugh lines. A lot of what he says, if you transcribe it literally, it might seem kind of hostile or challenging, but he's saying it in some ways just to kind of, you know, jerk on your sleeve and make you laugh or make you think. He's a trickster.
This profile you did of James Brown, I thought was just wonderful. I've remembered it ever since. And you were there. What was very interesting about it is that it was the Lion in Winter. It was late phase James Brown, and you were able to like talk to his musicians who both respected him, but also kind of knew it was. There was stuff you can't do with James Brown.
I was so fascinated by the culture of his band and, you know, the support structure that surrounded a guy like him. He's so outlandish and he's so demanding and he's so legendary, and he was also such a kind of hopeless case by that time, or maybe he had been for a long time on certain terms. He wouldn't organize his effort in a way that was going to result in really good music. So everyone was sort of just, you know, biting their tongue all the time. Well, you know, that's not going to work, but we can't tell him that's not going to work. It was almost like being, you know, hanging out with his band was like hanging out with the nuns in a dying church or something. You know, they all have to keep the faith, but they're all whispering in the corridors that, you know, God is actually dead or dying. Mm-hmm. I was transfixed by it. It was a unique phenomenon because, you know, I kept saying to these guys, why are you telling me this? You know, aren't you going to get fired?
You're gonna get fined.
And they'd say, he'll never read it. And it was like, you know, how many times do you get to write a major profile of someone and everyone guarantees you the guy is never going to know what you say?
So it's going to be in Rolling Stone.
I could say anything.
Hit it. How you feel, brother?
I feel pretty good, too. Author Jonathan Lethem, I spoke to him yesterday about his career and his latest novel, Dissident Gardens. If you'd like to hear more about that book and his career in music, including what inspired him to write a monograph about the Talking Heads album Fear of Music, you can hear the extended version of this interview at our website, kuow.org. This is The Record.
Take them up, Fred.